This is the Motorcycle Mentor Podcast with David Mixon, session number 16.
Welcome to the Motorcycle Mentor Podcast, where it's all about helping beginner riders, just like his motorcycle mentor helped him. And now your host, who hates riding when it's hot, David Mixon.
Hey everybody, this is David Mixon. Thanks for listening today to the Motorcycle Mentor Podcast. Today I'm going to play part three of my three-part interview with Ed Becker. Ed is the executive director of the Snell Memorial Foundation. If you haven't listened to part one and two of my interview with Ed, I really recommend that you do that before you listen to this part three. It'll just make a lot more sense if you go in order. Now that's podcast number 14 and 15. And you can also find a link to the interview on the show notes page, motorcyclementor.com/Snell. You can find a link to the part one and part two, and part three for that matter, of this interview, along with additional resources on the show notes page, including a transcript of the entire interview, a video of the log splitter crushing tested motorcycle helmets, and other material that I referenced here as well. Here's part three of my conversation with Ed. Let's talk about testing fees. I know you don't disclose specific financial information, but I assume there's a cost that the manufacturer incurs for testing and then an incremental cost for each helmet. Is that right?
That's right. And we actually post our fee structure on the Snell website. It's down under manufacturer information. Easy to get to. We charge for the tests that we do. We also require that the manufacturer reimburse us for our expenses in purchasing the samples we test in enforcement. And we charge for each sticker that we require be placed in the certified helmets. So those, each one of those helmets is actually subject to a sort of tax. Based on the certification labels that we sell the manufacturer. The test fee for certification testing is I think it's $1,040 for the five-sample test where we're actually can get all the necessary testing done on a single head form. Up to $1,560 if the helmets fit more than one head form. The random sample testing, the enforcement testing, we're actually charging $135 for an enforcement test. It's kind of a break, but then it's hard enough for a manufacturer to be required to pay retail for his helmets in the first place, so we don't want to add insult to injury. Then for the stickers that go inside the helmets, these days we're looking for 75 cents each for an M2010 certification label. That price is going to go up for M2015. Point of all that money is that we need it to keep the doors open and the lights on here and pay our salaries. We issue all the invoices here for test fees, certification labels, and what have you, but the money actually goes to an accountant firm in Texas, kind of a third-party accountant, and they get audited annually, our Snell account, by still another auditing firm to make sure that everything's on the up and up. The accounting firm also does all our government filings, issues our paychecks, reimburses expenses, all of that. The advantage of that system is that if they make a mistake, it's a mistake. Whereas if we ran our own money and made a mistake here, somebody would go to jail. I'm all in favor of the outside accountant.
Absolutely. Let's talk about helmets that fail to meet the Snell certification or the requirements. Why do helmets typically fail Snell certifications? Are there particular tests that are more difficult that cause the most problems?
The biggest problem is impact management. Just about all the other tests, the retention strength, the shell penetration even, certainly the chin bar test and roll off are matters that a manufacturer can deal with and correct really with no penalty. With impact management, we're looking for helmets that can manage really severe impacts, and that generally takes a bigger, bulkier helmet than what's required for DOT or EC, and the public is looking for sleek, lightweight headgear. So that there's a definite tug of war going on, and if the manufacturer has cut too many corners to get the weight and bulk down, you can wind up in trouble. In the impact testing, we'll see helmets that go down in impact with flat surfaces, because the EPS impact managing liner is too dense and just transmits too much shock through the head form. Then they might go down in testing against our hemispherical anvil. It's really a curved shape that puts a point loading on the shell. Because that load concentrating surface is punched through the shell and the liner and collapsed it completely and then transmitted the rest of the shock directly through the head form, potentially through to a wearer's head. What a manufacturer has to do is balance the liner density with the thickness and the shell rigidity to manage a broad range of impact surfaces. And in order to do that, we generally wind up either building a heavier helmet than they wanted to or going to a more expensive process and more expensive quality control and production procedures. If the helmets go down in impact, everything else, if the manufacturer has really been involved in helmet building for any period of time, is a snap.
How often does a helmet fail?
It depends, again, on the manufacturer. We'll see new manufacturers hardly ever pass the first time. It's happened, but generally because the manufacturer, the new guy, has poached all his engineering talent from an existing firm who knows what they're doing. Some of the most experienced manufacturers never fail. What's happening is that they're testing all their new designs in their own laboratory, and we only see the ones that pass. If something fails in their lab, it never sees the light of day after that. They go back to the drawing board and make it work. Those are the people that I like to deal with. It gets kind of depressing for our test technicians. We get a bunch of helmets in for certification from an established manufacturer. They know they're in for a pretty dull session of testing. They'll just sigh and do their best, but there's not likely to be a payoff.
What data or feedback do you give the manufacturer for helmets that pass?
We have a standard test report. Includes all the physical measurements that we did, and also charts showing the impact management of the helmet in each one of the impacts that we did impact they get about 2 pages of data for each helmet in the test series, plus a summary result. If they require more than that, we're happy to give them comments and what have you. Some manufacturers even request that the tested samples be returned to them so they can study those as well. Generally, though, a manufacturer with passing results is happy with the pass and does not ask too many questions beyond that. You might sock the data away in their file drawers, but they're happy to start to move that helmet into production. If the helmet fails, we may get some questions about why. Occasionally, a manufacturer will even come in to observe testing and we'll demonstrate the same problem for him when he comes in. But there again, there's only so much we can tell them. We think we know something about helmet testing, but we're positive that we don't know anything at all about helmet design and development. The fact is that if we know how to build good helmets, we'd probably be in a different line of business.
You test different sizes of helmets? You say you get different sample sizes, I guess, depending on how many different sizes they have in their line.
Yeah, definitely. We test each size configuration separately. Manufacturers will, when they produce a model line, will actually have two, as many as six distinct size configurations, essentially different helmets in that lineup. And we will test each one of those different helmets separately and certify them separately.
So just to be clear, I assume that's the same outer shell and the same EPS thickness, and then they have different foam padding to take you from a certain size to, say, the next smaller or next larger size?
Well, we consider a size configuration to be a single shell and liner combination, impact liner. The manufacturer may have several different comfort liners inside that shell and liner to accommodate a slightly broader range of head sizes. But the distinction that we make is that changes in the comfort liner don't do anything. We're interested in instead distinct shell and impact liner configurations, and we'll test each one of those separately. The five and seven helmet distinction I was talking about earlier is for helmets where a different comfort liner will essentially change the head form that the test head form that we use to test the helmet. Manufacturer may come in with a one shell and liner combination and have a comfort liner that's relatively thick and will accommodate that helmet to a 56-57 centimeter circumference head, and then another comfort padding that will accommodate that same shell and liner to a head circumference of 60 and 61 centimeters. And if that's the case, we would test four samples on a 60 centimeter head form, and then we would test two more samples on a 57 centimeter head form, and the helmet would be required to meet all the test requirements on both head forms.
What if one of your configurations fails and the other one passes?
If a shell and liner combination fails any of the tests we do to it, we stop right there. The helmet is rejected for certification. Occasionally, a manufacturer will decide that, okay, we got a passing result for the 57, say for the smaller size, but we ran out of energy management, larger size. They'll actually begin to produce a larger helmet, a separate shell and liner combination to accommodate that larger size, in which case we will proceed. But he certifies each distinct shell and liner separately, and he certifies them for a specific size range that he will state to us at the outset of the testing. And if the manufacturer only comes up with a limited size range, he is free to market that limited size range for that model. But we, in the licensing agreement, forbid selling a helmet outside that size range with that same model name, whether it's got a sticker or not. And we want all the helmets that he sells under that model name to be Snell certified. We don't want anybody confused about what's certified and what's not.
Let's talk about helmet care and maintenance. Do you have any tips for properly caring and maintaining your helmet?
And there, the best I can say is that the owner should read the instructions that come with the helmet. They have all kinds of good advice about just what kind of care is necessary for the helmet. I have noted that some helmets come with removable liners, comfort liners. Essentially, you can take the comfort padding and cloth out of the helmet and wash it and then put it back in. Figure this is a good idea. The some of the helmets that I get in here for that have been used and been sent in for evaluation stink worse than old sneakers. But it's strictly up to the wearer. After that, keep the helmet away from solvents, gasoline. Take reasonable care not to damage the interior of the helmet. I've seen a lot of motorcyclists who like to prop the helmet on a mirror. The problem is that every time you drop the helmet onto that mirror, the mirror is cutting into the EPS surface on the inside of the helmet. I don't know that a whole lot of damage is being done, but it's cumulative. It adds up. Do it often enough, and you're going to damage the helmet's ability to manage impact.
How often should riders replace their helmets?
Based on some research that Dr. Snively did with helmets that he got from retiring CHP officers, he came up with a 5-year replacement rule. He figured that helmet users should replace their helmets every 5 years with the clock starting the first time the helmet is worn. He found that even though some of these helmets that have been worn for many years by CHP officers performed like new out of the box, and many others that looked just as good have been reduced to mere decoration. And he decided that he could no longer recommend the helmet that had been in use for 5 years.
Let's talk about what's next for motorcycle helmet designs. What do you see in the next 5 or 10 years or longer? You know, what are the current trends looking like or that look exciting?
We've been pretty enthused about the helmet technology that's currently being used for Formula One racing helmets. They're using a special carbon fiber layup that is expensive, difficult to cure, but allows them to put as much as 20% more impact energy management into a reasonably sized helmet than the manufacturers are getting now with the standard fiberglass shells. And we think that this super helmet technology can really be a boon for motorcyclists, provided they can get the cost down. Right now, these Formula One helmets go for upwards of $3,000 a pop. And the hope is that when the demand is sufficient and the volume goes up, that that price will come down.
Let's talk about, do you ever see any fake Snell labels? Is that a problem?
I understand that there was a counterfeiting problem in the early 80s, seeing photographs of sheets of counterfeit Snell labels from way back then. It was mostly in auto racing. But since then, since I've been aboard, since 1989, I've actually only seen one counterfeit label, and that was in a counterfeit helmet. There's a big market for counterfeit, for replica auto racing helmets, helmets that are done up in the particular racers' colors. People buy them really to put on their mantelpieces and show off to their friends. They're hardly ever used. This one helmet had a handmade plastic Snell SA certification label for auto racing that. Actually quite cleverly done, but I'm sure it was a one-off, and the most I ever did about it was contacted the manufacturer who at least made the helmet that was being counterfeited, and let him know what was going on. This was down in Brazil, I think, where the helmet came from.
Ed, it's time for the Motorcycle Mentor Lightning Round. This is where I'm going to ask you a series of final questions, and they're kind of quick questions. You can answer them as short or as long as you'd like, and you can pass on any one of them. Are you ready?
I'll do the best I can.
Okay. What helmet modifications are okay, and what helmet modifications are not okay?
We generally recommend against helmet modifications at all. If we don't get the rule on them, in any case, if they're done aftermarket, we only deal with the new helmets here in our testing. But if a rider really needs to modify his helmet, then our advice, at least to safety inspectors, is that they allow modifications that are useful, that are competently done, and that do not reasonably degrade the protective capabilities of the helmet. So it would just about exclude projections on the outside of the shell, anything that would serve as a load concentrator that might punch through the shell in an impact, and certainly anything that changes the mass of the helmet or shifts the center of gravity notably away from where it is, say out to one side or up higher. I think that especially the cameras that a lot of people do mount on helmets are a very bad idea. Just been hearing about Michael Schumacher and the camera that he had mounted on a ski helmet. It really precipitated a lot of his injuries out in Europe.
What percentage of total helmets that you certify are motorcycle helmets?
Actually, the bulk of the helmets that we certify here are motorcycle helmets. Snively started out with the auto racing helmet standards, but motorcyclists started wearing them almost immediately. And it's been the motorcycle helmet program that's been keeping the doors open and the lights on for the past 50 years.
Does Snell support or contribute to research in helmet design, including alternate helmet designs?
Not directly. We do research for issues affecting standards. In some cases, we've looked at low velocity response to motorcycle helmets just recently. We determined, we think pretty persuasively, that the difference between a Snell helmet and a DOT helmet really only turns up when the impact velocities start to increase beyond 8 meters a second. And what we see is that the low velocity response tracks along pretty much the same for both kinds of helmets. The difference is that the DOT certified helmets may run out of gas and stop, be used up completely well before a Snell certified helmet will.
And how fast was that? How many meters per second?
8 meters a second was our where we found most of the DOT helmets started to be overwhelmed in flat impact. Some of them began to be overwhelmed at 6 and 7 meters a second impact with a hemispheric helmet. The difference in the helmets, as nearly as we can see it, is that Snell does provide protection in bigger thumps than DOT or ECE.
What's the difference between a $400 Snell-approved helmet and a $100 Snell-approved helmet?
I gave a snarky answer for that one, $300. But the what we have seen here is that the higher-priced helmets generally come in more size configurations within a model line. Instead of two or three different size configurations, the manufacturers will actually be making five and six different helmets to fill out a size range. What it means is that no matter what your size, you're getting a helmet that pretty much matches your head dimensions. You're not putting a small head into a big cavity that's filled up with a lot of foam comfort material.
Are there any plans for Snell to certify other motorcycle riding gear, such as body armor, gloves, different things like that?
Not at all. We're strictly head protection helmet monomaniacs. We are mostly concerned with brain injury, but we'll deal with any aspect of protective headgear. Once we get beyond that, there's no real push for us to expand.
And lastly, Ed, I want to ask you a question that needs to be answered by someone we can trust. Should we replace our motorcycle helmet if we drop it?
And there, our answer is no. The helmets protect really because even after the shell hits the ground, a head inside the helmet gets to keep on trucking, and it will crush that impact liner between it and the immobilized shell as it goes. But if there's no head inside the helmet when it hits the ground, there's nothing to crush that liner. The damage is going to be imperceptible. That helmet is, for all purposes, as good as just before it was dropped. We still recommend that people handle their helmets carefully, avoid dropping them. Even slight amounts of damage will add up over a period of time. But a single drop is no reason, I think, for someone to run out and have to buy a new helmet.
How can somebody get in touch with you, Ed, if they have further questions or, wanted to see your test set up?
We have our website, www.smf.org. There's email addresses for just about all the staff members on it, including my own, ed@smf.org. I'm happy to answer any questions if someone wants to put to me. We also conduct tours from time to time for small groups. We can't handle much more than 10 to 15 people at a time, but groups will contact us here and arrange for a tour, usually on a weekend. We'll have them in, give them maybe an hour's presentation explaining who we are and what we do, take them out to the lab, show them exactly how we go about testing a helmet, do a couple of demonstration drops, get a sense of what's going on. Yeah, we're happy to do it. We get lots of school kids in from time to time. They all want to come back and test helmets for Snell because our technicians get to break stuff all day long.
I have one final request, Ed. If somebody has a comment or question about what you said today, would you be willing to answer their questions directly on the site at the bottom of the show notes page, say for the next week or so?
Sure.
And I can help, you know, notify you when people that may keep some of the email traffic down to you. And some people may have the same questions that other people have.
I'll be happy to do whatever I can.
So in closing, Ed, I want to thank you again for speaking with me today. And, you know, I really thought about this the other night when I was thinking about Snell in general. You know, what you do actually helps the motorcycle riding community. You know, what he did to begin with to further advance motorcycle helmet technology helps all of us as riders. And I wanted to thank you for doing that. I really appreciate that.
Oh, thanks very much. That's really what we're here for. If we're not doing that, pretty soon everyone will catch on and we'll dry up and blow away. So it's important that we be of some use to the motorcycle riding community.
So there you have it. Part 3 of my interview with Ed Becker, Executive Director of the Snell Memorial Foundation. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Ed as much as I did. If you'd like to hear more interviews like this for the future podcast, shoot me an email. I'd love to hear from you. And again, I'll post the additional resources I've mentioned in these 3 podcasts on the show notes page, motorcyclementor.com/Snell. Thanks again, Ed, for coming on the show. As always, you can contact me directly, motorcyclementor@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the podcast, would you share it on Facebook or Twitter or your favorite motorcycle forum? Thanks in advance for doing this. It really helps. So until next time, this is David Mixon, challenging you to enjoy the outdoors on 2 wheels.
Thanks for listening to the Motorcycle Mentor Podcast at motorcyclementor.com.